This week, the Dow Jones Industrials finished at yet another all-time record weekly close. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you again this weekend. We've got another Muy Grande-sized episode with top industry professionals and the market headlines affecting your portfolio. James Turk and Louis Navalier stop by with their market outlooks. James Turk says gold is more backward dated than at any time in history, or at least decades. This suggests extreme tightness in supply, making a forceful move higher all the more likely. And the gold source of last resort is central bank coffers, which continue to shift stockpiles from the west to the east. Ukraine's gold reserves may have been targeted by the powers that be as a temporary panacea to lessen tight gold market conditions, but backwardation persists regardless, suggesting that the ultimate day of reckoning for the bears can't be too far away. Then Louis Navalier joins me. He says negative yields in Europe presents cheap cash for U.S. companies to buy back their own shares, reducing stock float and increasing demand. The housing sector is following the equities market's lead, moving sharply higher to new highs. Lower gas prices at the pumps, another big plus for our GDP and the equities, lowering expenses and encouraging consumer spending. And high-tech stocks are roaring back. NXP Semiconductor is a supplier to Apple Company, which could benefit from record iPhone sales. And next year could be another big year for the market. If rates stay low, money managers and corporate treasurers will purchase shares via buybacks, shrinking supply and increasing demand. For our Alpha subscribers, we had another couple of grand slams. The Alpha Stocks newsletter continues to trounce the indexes. You can find the sign-up links at our webpage or on the email messages. And I've identified a new hedge fund strategy which shows virtually unlimited upside and zero risk, doesn't involve any options or derivatives. All funds are invested in stock and bond commodity mutual funds, but each client has the opportunity to double their money with no extra risk. So while we're shadowing the stock and bond markets with excellent diversification, a small fraction goes into high return opportunities, but zero capital is risk. If you're interested in this, my plate is kind of full right now, but if you have experience or capital or know someone who does, please contact me at gsr@hughes.net. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Clouds return to the precious metals market after three solid weeks amid the energy market implosion. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX Exchange, gold gave back just $35, about 3%, finishing at $1,165 an ounce. A solid showing considering the commodities market selling. Silver gave back $1.06, ending at $1,536 an ounce. The XEU and silver equities dropped 7%, off 5.4 points, ending at $6,839, while palladium added 17, closing at $809, amid rumors of increased tensions between Ukraine and Russia. Platinum was off $25, ending at $1,200 an ounce, while West Texas Intermediate crude dropped $10.70, off 14% for the week, ending at $65.99 per barrel. A top story moving the precious metals sector was the unfortunate implosion in West Texas Intermediate crude. Oil plunged the most in over 3 years on news in Vienna this Thursday by OPEC Secretary General Abdullah al-Badari. A news conference that the 12-nation OPEC countries would hold their supply target steady, their quota remained unchanged, lowering inflation expectations globally. The news sent the greenback to multi-year highs on global capital flows, which tilted in favor of the U.S. economic engine, which lives and breathes on low petroleum prices. Some analysts noted the likely negative impact on U.S. shale and fracking companies. Another story holding the gold market up, despite the commodity sell-off, a key Swiss vote this weekend on Sunday, a referendum to force officials to buy twice the current government stockpile of gold. Investors held gold positions ahead of the event, even though it's not expected to pass as of Friday. Switzerland will vote on Sunday, November 30th, on the initiative requiring the National Bank to maintain 20% of assets in gold, more than twice current levels. Some voters are undecided. A vote of yes would likely cause some short covering, while a vote of no could bring the bears back to the markets. Elsewhere, officials in India ended a key ban on gold imports from 2013. The Reserve Bank of India removed the requirement for firms to export 20% of their gold imports in the form of jewelry. It was known as the 80-20 rule. It contributed to weakening in India's demand for gold. The bullish news is likely another component holding the precious metals a bit higher relative to commodities. In domestic news, transportation companies flew higher this week on plunging energy costs, which helped to offset dour U.S. economic reports on Wednesday. One airline company, ticker LUV, blasted higher. The weekly unemployment number increased to 313,000, well above expectations. Anything over 300,000 is sometimes viewed as a recessionary number. Plus, the Chicago area business conditions were lower than anticipated. Nevertheless, durable goods orders and consumer sentiment were solid, with the highest reading since 2007. Precious metals bottom line. Similar to last week, the U.S. dollar is still very strong here, which did pause the gold rally as predicted in the last report. And given the extent of the energy market and CRB deluges well below support, and the fact that the metals closed at lows, further selling is likely next week. The near-term outlook is somewhat bearish. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the 6 week running. The Dow Jones rose 2.5% in November. 12 of this year's 31 record closes occurred this month. The Dow inched higher only 18 points, about 0.10%, ending at 17,828, the highest weekly close in national history. The S&P 500 added 4, up about 0.2%, finishing at 2063, while the NASDAQ added 79 points, 1.7%, ending at 4791. Black Friday marked the official holiday shopping season. Walmart led the Dow components higher with a gain of $2.56, or 3%, to $87.54 on the world's biggest retailer. Also the biggest gainer in the index this month, up 15%. Strong consumer confidence numbers and lower energy prices virtually ensures stronger retail sales, and it suggests higher share prices. When the consumer is happy and living and transportation expenses drop, out comes the wallets and pocketbooks, and in comes corporate profits and higher share prices. Well, our trusty 7 Indicator Fear Index finally reached greedy levels this week after 2 solid months of buying, so it appears the herd is nearly all in here. So caution is somewhat advisable for the next week or two. For next week's forecast and all the stock candidates, I'd like for you to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. Well, James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com and author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar, How to Profit from It. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. Always great to speak with you.
You know, you spoke recently talking about backwardation again, noting that this could be the worst that we've seen. Gold is just more backward dated than almost any other time you've seen looking at it over the years. Tell us why you think this is significant for the markets, please.
Yeah, first of all, backwardation should not happen. You know, gold is money, and all monies in the relationship to other monies, you know, to national currencies, depend on principally on their interest rate. And because gold has the lowest interest rate, it should always be in contango against the U.S. dollar. The reason being is that gold cannot be, physical gold cannot be created out of thin air like national currencies can. So national currencies can be easily inflated away, but gold cannot be. So it has the lowest interest rate. So in theory, backwardation shouldn't happen, but it has happened because of government intervention in the market. They've been keeping the gold price down in order to make the dollar look better than it really deserves to be viewed as, because, you know, the dollar is being debased, central banks are printing. This is true for the euro, obviously the yen as well, and other national currencies. They're all being debased by national current central bank money printing. So when backwardation occurs, it's an extremely rare event. It happened for a couple of days in at the low in the gold price in 1999. It happened for a couple of days at the low of the gold price in 2008. And here it's been happening for quite a period of time over the past year and a half. And you know, the backwardation we've seen recently, we've never seen it that deep before, which suggests that, you know, there really is a shortage of physical metal. In other words, people would rather own physical metal then take the profit opportunity that arises from the arbitrage on the backwardation. In other words, if you had physical metal today, you could sell it and buy it back in the future at a lower price, profiting that way. You avoid the storage fee because you sold your metal, so you avoid that cost, which is essentially a profit. And the third way you profit is you have the proceeds from your sale to use until you have to buy back your gold in the future. But people aren't taking that arbitrage, which suggests that they would rather own physical metal than profit from the potential arbitrage because they see the risk of future delivery as just too high to take that risk. That's why the backwardation is deepening. As it deepens, it's trying to find a level at which people are prepared to take that risk, but so far that's not happening.
Tight supply conditions, I guess, is the bottom line here. I mean, there's just not a surplus of gold, and there's been several rumors that have been floating around the precious metals community regarding tight supply conditions, voracious demand from Asia, as well as India and Russia. Where is this demand coming from? They're already consuming more than the world supplies each year. Where does it originate? Some speculation that that's coming from the ETFs, from Western central banks.
Well, first of all, there are 8 tons of newly mined gold coming into the market every day. If that were sufficient to supply the existing demand without drawing from existing above-ground stocks, there wouldn't be any backwardation. So we know right now that the daily demand is greater than the newly mined gold of 8 tons that's coming to the market every day. So you have to look at, well, people who want to buy physical metal, they're still getting physical metal. Where is it coming from, which is the question you raise. It could be coming from the ETFs. I've read the prospectus on GLD, and I've looked at some of the other ones. GLD in particular has so many gaps and holes in that prospectus that, yes, they could very well be leasing and taking gold out of that, the vault and just putting an IOU in its place with the intention of replacing the gold at some future date. I think that is possible. But to me, given the demand we're seeing and the flows of metal that we're seeing, I think the ETFs are pretty well picked clean. This has to be coming from central bank vaults, in my view. There's just too much metal being demanded and being shipped around the world for it to come from any other source other than central bank vaults. It brings me back to what happened in the 1960s, when there was this cartel of central banks called the London Gold Pool. They kept on dishoarding gold. The U.S. government dishoarded 10,000 tons of gold from Fort Knox to try to make the market believe that gold was worth only $35 an ounce, which was the exchange rate back then, when the market knew that it was worth more. And the similar thing is happening now. They're trying to keep gold under $1,200 an ounce. Central banks are trying to do that. One, in fact, the market believes that gold is worth more than $1,200 an ounce. And based on all my valuation models, my mathematical models, it is worth more than $1,200 per ounce. It's very undervalued here. So it's a similar type of battle. Back then, the price of gold was fixed. Today, the price of gold is floating, but it's essentially the same. The other big difference is that we could see the flows out of central banks back in the 1960s. It was recorded, and today those flows are not being recorded. They're just being disguised in central bank balance sheets, which is unfortunate. So there's a lot of supposition as to how much gold central banks have really put in the market and what they've got left. But I think you got to be, we have to be thinking, given the size of the flows of gold over the months, that there can't be very much left in central bank vaults without emptying those vaults completely. And I really doubt whether central banks would take that step to completely empty their vault. Although a couple central banks have actually done that. Australia got rid of all of its gold. Canada got rid of all of its gold, which is really unfortunate for both of those two countries, because as the fiat monetary system ultimately comes to its logical conclusion, which is a loss of purchasing power and maybe a destruction of those fiat currencies, those two countries won't have gold to reconstruct their own new currency system.
Speaking of central banks, gold, we've read story after story now that Ukraine apparently has divested its gold, or at least it has sent it offshore, and it's been confirmed, I think, this week that most of it, if not all of it, was sent to the United States after months of rumors.
But, you know, this is really very interesting about the Ukraine gold. It's something really hit the newspapers recently, but the reality is that there were a lot of rumors in the market back in the spring, back in March, that when the tensions in Ukraine were heating up, the gold was taken out of Ukraine and supposedly returned to the Federal Reserve. But at the same time that was taking place, the backwardation that had previously been in the gold price mysteriously disappeared, which was suggesting that a lot of physical metal was coming into the market. So my view was at the time that gold came out of Ukraine and didn't go to the Federal Reserve in New York. It went to Switzerland so that it could be put into the international gold lending and movement, the physical side of the market. Because the physical side of the market is not located in the States. It's located in London and Switzerland and to a certain extent Hong Kong. So I think what happened was the Ukraine gold back in the spring was taken out of Ukraine, supposedly told, the rumors were it was sent to the Federal Reserve, but I think it was sent to Switzerland and put in the market. And that eliminated the contango and provided, I think it was 47 tons of gold or something like that, provided some additional liquidity, which enabled the backwardation to disappear for a period of time. So, the backwardation is back, and it suggests that, central banks are running out of physical metal.
Well, speaking of central banks and money flows and capital, one of the major themes we've seen, especially over the last year or so, capital flight into the United States. And some of this is obviously the result of Abenomics, as well as QE operations from the BOJ and the ECB. This capital, the scared money, frightened money, do you see that as a potential to, I guess, reignite the inflation theme and support the precious metals?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty bullish here on the precious metals. So obviously I've been bullish from a long-term point of view and remain bullish over the long term as this fiat currency problem continues to work its way through the system and as fiat currencies continue to lose value over the long term. But even on a short-term basis, I'm pretty bullish on the gold price because we had this bottom formed at 1180, and we took out the 1180, we went down to 1130, and then we snapped right back. What gold is now in the process of doing is forming a key reversal. It looks like that break below 1180 was a bear trap. It wasn't the continuation of the correction. It was a bear trap shaking out the last of the remaining of the weak hands, hitting the stops that were below the market, and now gold has snapped back. This B bottom will continue to form if we next get above 1200 and get to, say, 1240 by the end of the year. If that happens, then I think the odds will definitely have shifted in favor that the correction in gold that began 3 years ago has ended and that the resumption of the long-term bull market in gold will have resumed. That's what my expectation is.
Referring to money flows into the United States, and much of that, of course, directed into equities, such a broad equities market, 15 or more thousand stocks, numerous derivative products that are available to virtually any institution with deep pockets. And, there's considerable talk that many of our institutions, financial institutions, even central banks, have been redirecting billions, if not even trillions of dollars, into U.S. equities, bonds, and real estate. So this trend, you might think of it as perhaps a giant sponge absorbing much of the money or inflation that might have otherwise been directed to commodities. When do you see this theme changing?
I don't see it changing because all central banks know is print, print, print. That money has to go somewhere. But I think the stock market will continue to go up. But we have to distinguish and look at the stock market in terms of what it really is. It's not a stock market. It's a market of stocks. And generally speaking, there are two broad categories. You've got stocks, equities of companies that are involved in real assets and creating wealth from tangible assets, for example, Exxon. And mining companies. But on the other side, you have financial companies, banks, mortgage companies, credit card companies. I think that, just generally speaking, as a currency loses purchasing power because of money printing and people try to find places to put that that currency. It's going to go into real things, real assets, land, gold, silver, and approximations for real assets, the equities of companies that are involved in real things. A company like an Exxon, a company like a mining company, those companies, I think, will continue to do well. But I think financial companies will not. I don't think banks will do well in what I believe will be the ultimate collapse of the dollar. I expect the dollar to collapse just like the continental collapsed. You know, the continental was the first currency of the newly independent United States of America. And because of the collapse of the continental, which was the currency during the War of Independence, the framers created the Constitution in order to create a more perfect union. And one of the key elements of that more perfect union was to have gold and silver as sound money. We abandoned the wisdom of the framers in 1971, and we're living with the same consequences today as the framers did with the continental back in the 1780s. So it's quite distressing to see that abandoning the wisdom of the framers and we're having to relearn history all over again.
As I've added before, you know, I think they also had front row seats to the French revolutions, plural, and particularly the last that was obviously the result of horrible monetary schemes. And they tried every type of bailout. I guess we call it bailout today. And nothing seemed to work. They threw every panacea at the problem, and they just couldn't revive the economic patient. And I think our framers, as you call them, founders, recognized that this was perhaps the most socially destabilizing prospect on the horizon. They said if we were really going to try to make this experiment work, we had to have some very sound, firm contingencies in place to make sure that our monetary system was going to remain solvent. James Turk, we thank you so much today for your time. Tell people a bit more about goldmoney.com, please.
Yeah, I'm the founder of Gold Money, which is a very convenient way to purchase and sell gold and silver, platinum, palladium online, and have it professionally stored for you in different vaults around the world to give you a lot of diversification. And I'm also the co-author of my latest book with John Rubino. It's called The Money Bubble. And it actually does, Chris, get into some of these concepts that we've just discussed in this short conversation.
Very good. Well, I want everyone to direct their browsers over to at least Amazon.com and pick up a copy, not to mention that the holidays are coming. What a great gift idea. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates, also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Great to be here.
Third quarter earnings announcement season is underway, and you say that growth stocks have a tendency to liven up after announcements during their earnings season. There's good signs in the market. Bargain hunters abound. Low treasury bond yields are also a positive. Please tell us more.
Sure. Well, first of all, I actually expected earnings to decelerate in the third quarter, and they didn't. The S&P's earnings were up about 10.3. You know, my portfolios are designed in much stronger earnings, so I'm well over 40% earnings growth. But the sales did decelerate a bit, not so much for me, but for the overall market. And what's causing this is the strong dollar. The strong dollar pinches the profits of multinationals like a Coke, a McDonald's, an IBM, and, of course, a lot of the energy stocks. Because as the dollar gets stronger, it shoves down commodity prices. The other thing that's very interesting that's going on is that the low interest rate environment is getting worse. There's this worldwide limbo contest, and zero is not the floor. Over in Europe, they actually have negative yields. So what's happened is American companies are going over there, borrowing in the bond markets. Apple's the most recent one to do it, at ultra-low rates, even lower than getting in the United States, and buying their stock back. They're relentless, and it's going to be quite fascinating to see what happens.
You also say November, a traditionally strong month, particularly with midterm elections.
We rally going into the holidays. We've always had an early January effect. We're having one now. It's very clear. So I expect that this rally we've seen is going to continue for the rest of the year, and then we'll gap up in the beginning of the new year. You know, anytime the market goes up on light volume, it's a very, very good sign. So it's looking awfully good right now.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about the OPEC decision. You know, I'm sure you saw that West Texas Intermediate crude, it was just cratering over the holiday. OPEC decided not to curtail supply. You would think on the one hand, this would be a big positive because, you know, lower cost, lower transportation cost, more buying, lower corporate expenses, stronger share prices. However, some analysts have pointed to plunging oil prices just before the 2007-2008 market swoon. Any thoughts?
I think there's a lot of things going on. First of all, the people in Texas aren't happy right now. They've invested disproportionately in what we call master limited partnerships that pay very generous yields and have been really causing the domestic energy boom in the United States. So I know they're very, very upset. Another big oil service company on Wednesday suspended its dividend, and that really shocked people. We are in the middle of holiday trading now, so even though West Texas is at $66 a barrel, let's see where it settles out in the next couple of days. And I think the real test for oil is in the spring. Demand goes up in the spring, and let's just see what it does then. But in the meantime, they're shooting everything, and it's unfortunate. You know, the refiners make more money with low prices like this. The pipeline companies should not get hurt because they're still based on the volume. The other big theory out there that's going on is there's a lot of debt out there, and in the oil patch. And there's this theory that some of the bonds that fund a lot of the drilling are going to default. So we've got the shorts really trying to attack a lot of these energy companies, and it's very, very unfortunate what they're doing. We'll just have to wait and see where the prices are going to be in the spring, in all candor. I think today's action is quite shocking. It's thin market conditions. Don't think this will continue every day.
Very good. Well, you know, housing starts have also picked up. It almost seems to move lockstep with the general equities markets, the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index, a good proxy, I think, for the sector. Just incredible strength, and the home builders as well perking back up. Do you see another solid year in the housing sector?
Yeah, I really do. I think the bottom line is more people are getting jobs. They may not have the jobs everybody wants, but we do have employment growth. We do have confidence on the rise. So I do expect a smooth but steady housing recovery, and that's important. The weak housing market was one reason GDP couldn't grow. But our economy is on track for, my goodness, we've had the strongest GDP growth the last two quarters since 2003. Everything's going to decelerate a bit in the fourth quarter, but I think we're on track for almost 3% GDP growth, and housing has to participate to sustain that 3% GDP growth.
You know, retail sales also off. Should we discount this number here?
I think we have to discount it. Let's see where Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales are. But obviously the low gas prices are putting more money in consumers' pockets. We have more people getting jobs now. Confidence is definitely improving. There'll be pockets of the economy that will be grumpy. Texas will be grumpy because of low energy prices. The farm belt's grumpy because we grew too much wheat and soybeans, so the prices are down there. I think it's going to be fine. I'm not too worried about retail sales. I think it doesn't really measure the online boom that's going on.
Well, China, interesting numbers from that rousing tiger country. Of course, exports climbing about 15%. The PBOC just dropped interest rates, if I'm not mistaken, the lowest level in several years. Do you see improved conditions in China, and could that spill over here in the United States?
I'm very comfortable and confident that China is going to stimulate their economy with a rate cut. We already have a lot of wealthy Chinese buying homes all up and down the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. We see the rich Russians buy homes here. It's actually pretty interesting, the capital flight around the world. China is still the big economic engine in the world. They're just going to ensure that they grow at a certain pace, and you've got to give them credit for doing that.
Exactly. Okay. The commodity sector, of course, suffering along with energy. Do you see that group of stocks and related commodities suffering over the next 6, 12 months?
I see all commodities suffering. The dollar shuts down all commodity prices. The only exception would be beef, chicken, and pork. Beef prices are high because Texas is in a drought, so we don't have as many cows as we normally do. And then last year we had severe winter, and we're already having a severe winter this year. And that just makes the cows go to a special place, a happy place. And so what's happened is you got high beef prices, chickens up as a beef substitute, and the poor pigs are sick. Now, I was in Alabama at a barbecue joint the other day, and they ran out of pork. that's how acute the pork shortage is. The high poultry prices and beef and chicken prices help the Tyson Foods of the world. I like Pilgrim's Pride as well. Feed costs are low. That's the only inflation player I have is food prices.
You know, there's several red-hot sectors right now in the equities markets, and I know that you have a tendency to keep your finger on the pulse of some of the more interesting plays. Is there anything that's caught your attention you'd like to share with the listeners today?
Well, tech is doing a lot better. Tech's global. I think a lot of it is Apple lifting the whole sector, buying its stock back. There's stocks like Skyworks Solutions, NXPI, their suppliers to Apple. So I think that's one of the oases out there. Apple's created a lot of excitement with the iPhone. The iPhone is obviously going to generate sales for a few quarters here. First they launched in the United States and then in China. But there's something Apple did that's quite brilliant with the iPhone. They engineer it like a bar of soap. And when you drop them, it cracks really easily because the glass is curved now. So they're not as durable as the old ones were. So I expect the replacement cycle is going to be quite high.
Do you expect, you know, some of this wafer and wearable technology that's coming down the pike, do you expect that to continue to help lift shares? I mean, it's been one of the stronger tech companies in the last few months.
Well, I think the watch, which doesn't come out to next year, is just a peripheral. Like you can have a wireless headphones, you can have a wireless device called a Fitbit. I know the new Apples are measuring your health and everything too, but you know, the little Fitbit might be easier to hold than the big phone. You know, I think Apple's doing the right thing, you know, having more things communicate to the phone. You know, they're working on, obviously diabetic pumps that talk to your iPhone and things like that. And that would all be Bluetooth in. The watch is just another little device. Whether it will be more convenient than the actual phone, it's not a matter. So I think that it's not going to be I don't anticipate it to be a massive hit. I just think it's another Bluetooth device.
So just not another iPod or iPhone.
It's a Bluetooth device. You know, the kids don't like to wear watches because they tell their time on their phone. I know Apple's trying to get the kids to wear the watch. That will be the big, big thing. If they can get the kids to wear the watch, then I take it all back.
So ironic to think that watches are becoming antiquated. Well, as we wrap up, it looks like we could just see another solid year in the equities markets. Any parting comments?
Lock and load. I hate to be a depressing person, but my average stock is going to be gone 15 years at the current buyback pace. If rates do not go higher, buybacks will continue unabated. That is the story. The stock market is shrinking. It's disappearing. I know we have IPOs like Alibaba and GoPro and Twitter, but the amount of stock outstanding is shrinking. And so corporate America continues to aggressively buy its stock back. And P ratios are very low. They haven't gone up as much as the stocks haven't gone up as much as their earnings have gone up. So I'm very, very bullish. I think the next couple of years is going to be good. And traditionally, the third and fourth year presidential election term is a great year for the market.
Well, it's ironic you would mention that because one of our stock picks from 2 days ago, Kimberly Clark, just skyrocketed today, I don't know, almost 4%, primarily due to those buybacks that you're referring to. We're watching buybacks closely, and it tends to propel the companies higher. Tell folks more about the services you provide, please.
Well, basically, we have free stock graders. My free stock grader is on NavalierGrowth.com, my newsletter site. We would encourage everybody to go there and register for it. But you have my database of 5,000 stocks online free. So everybody should take advantage of that.
Louis Navalier, we thank you for taking time for us today and wish you continued success in the upcoming new year.
Thank you. Take care.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Dr. Stephen Lieb has over a quarter century of investment experience, author of 7 bestsellers, including The Oil Factor, The Coming Economic Collapse, and Game Over, his latest Red Alert, How China's Growing Prosperity Threatens the American Way of Life. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Start off today with some of the topicality. For instance, there's been, well, the geopolitical situation, at least for a while, was red hot.
Obviously, you have I think they call it a caliphate or caliphate or however you pronounce it, that is now occupying about a third of Iraq and, you know, a big chunk of Syria. It appears, you know, they're extremists to the extreme, every bit as extreme as Al-Qaeda, of which they're an offshoot, and they're self-financing, and it's clear that they have their eyes set on places like Saudi Arabia. They're Sunni, and the Saudis are Sunni. And the Saudis are a bifurcated society. About two-thirds of the Saudis are wealthy. Another third are Sunnis and not very wealthy. So they're in a position to recruit and to make a lot of trouble in a lot of the Middle East. And it would be very silly to take these people as, just another threat. Basically, America has said they're not going to put feet on the ground or put boots on the ground, and airstrikes are not, you know, they may contain them to some extent, but they're not going to diminish their recruiting efforts. If anything, they may strengthen their recruiting efforts. And I think our response to the crisis so far, arming the so-called Syrian rebels, is ridiculous. I mean, it's just like... It's like we're trying to beat ourselves. I mean, you're arming pharmacists and proprietors of dry cleaning shops, et cetera, and these weapons are almost surely going to end up in the hands of the militants. So I think there is a lot to worry about geopolitically. The fact that it hasn't yet hurt oil prices and that commodities have been under some pressure, you know, this doesn't mean too much. I mean, this is a world, and it's always been the stock market and the world we've been in for a long time to come, for a long time, at least in most of my lifetime, has always been a world that can change dramatically. Markets can change dramatically. I won't say overnight, but they can change dramatically in a very, very short period of time. So I think it's a mistake to write off, what's happening in the Middle East as not, you know, important geopolitically. It is. It's exceptionally important. If this group of militants can start recruiting Sunnis from, you know, all parts of the Middle East, it could be very, very important. And I just don't see any real hope of gathering a Middle East army against them. I mean, they represent, you know, the same kinds of thinking that a lot of Middle Easterners believe in, unfortunately, very unfortunately. And I just don't think that we get it. I really don't. I don't think you're going to see the Turks fighting against them. I don't think you're going to see any real boots on the ground. I think that, you know, what we're doing with airstrikes is about what we're going to end up doing, and I don't think that's really going to stop them, unfortunately.
I know that listeners will want to hear the panacea that you are proposing that is contrary to our officials' current plan of action.
My panacea would be probably feet on the ground, boots on the ground, but unfortunately, it may be too late in the day. I mean, we sort of wasted that alternative when we went into Iraq the first time. Our panacea right now, I mean, I wouldn't call it a panacea, is to keep our fingers crossed, toes crossed, and everything crossed, that Iraq can form a government and that government can run an army. But that's really a long shot, because you're asking a government that's headed by a Shiite to unite a country that is filled with very, very strong beliefs, that of which, you know,
only part are Shiites. You need Sunnis and you need Kurds behind you, and it's going to be very, very difficult to, you know, have a united government under those conditions. But that has to be the panacea. Whatever we can do to, you know, forward that, that would be great. If the Iraqi army is able to, be a real force against this collection of militants, that would be great. But other than that, I think that's last I heard that the new government, they finally have gotten rid of Maliki, thank goodness. But the new government is headed by a bright guy. There's no doubt about it. But they still don't have a defense minister. Now, how are you going to fight a war without a defense minister? I mean, it strikes me that's a pretty important position to fill. You know, I'm not saying it looks hopeless at this point, but it doesn't look great. I mean, you know, panacea would be further protection, further monies to help the Saudis along in terms of protecting their assets. But my gosh, how much more money can we give them? I mean, you know, it's just not a good situation. And it's a situation that I think people have to be aware of. In the sense that it can change, it could change overnight, or not overnight, but over a period of not too long a period, it could change and, you know, change for the worse.
Don't you feel that our allies, however weak those ties may have become in recent decades due to our own actions, at least partially, the concerted, unified action to stabilize the Middle East. I mean, for instance, one of our top allies, Israel, could be jeopardized if this situation becomes even more unstable.
Israel's very worried about this. I mean, they've said as much. I mean, they said this is one of the reasons that they're not going after Hamas as aggressively as they were. Because this is a threat. It's a threat to the entire Middle East. There's no doubt about it. Look, the Middle East is a highly fractured place. I mean, you know, the Arab Spring, I mean, you know, it proves it, the failure of it. And now you have this group springing up that, you know, controls vast amounts of territory, self-funding, and has aspirations that, you know, basically include everything. So it's, you know, what can Israel do? I mean, you know, not a whole lot, and I haven't even mentioned Iran. I mean, you know, the Iranians would be a natural foe to these people because the Iranians are Shiites, and these people are Sunnis. And the Iranians, they could do something. If their feet were on the ground and they were marching with the Iraqis, that would mean something. But the Iranians, in my opinion, and I think they've said as much already, would want they basically would want permission de facto. That's what they're saying. They're not saying it in so many words, but they're saying it in effect. They want permission to build the nuclear bomb in order to help with these people. So I mean, you know, talk about being caught between a rock and a hard place. There you are. I mean, do you let the Iranians build a nuclear bomb so that they'll help you? Maybe help you against this group of militants, or do you just let the group of militants run on and hope that the Iraqis themselves can assemble an army? And, you know, let's not forget, and you mentioned Israel before. I mean, I think that Israel, if they sense that the Iranians were building a nuclear bomb, I think they take action. This is not something that has simple solutions. There are no simple solutions. There are no panaceas. This is a long time in the making. And it's a pox on a lot of people's houses, not just Bush, but a lot of people, not just Obama, but a lot of people. There's been, you know, a lot of drop balls here. Their deal with us is that they won't. I don't think that Iran, despite all their flamboyant protestations, et cetera, is really so much interested in Europe or interested in Israel. I think they're much more interested in Saudi Arabia.
Ah.
And I think that, you know, a nuclear-armed Iran would, you know, basically make them, you know, king of the Middle East. So, I mean, would you rather have Iran or would you rather have this militant group? Now, if Iran did become nuclear-armed, then I think you'd have Israel dropping tactical nuclear weapons to try and destroy the Iranian nuclear capacity. And, you know, then that just becomes a holy mess of all sorts. You know, it's just terrible. I mean, I wish I could put a better spin on it, but you know, this is why I advise, or one of the reasons I advise almost everybody, or everybody, in fact, not almost everybody, but anyone that, you know, can, that I think they've got to have precious metals, gold, et cetera, in their portfolios. I think it's an absolute necessity, Chris. Absolute necessity. And we're not even talking about the role Russia plays with Iran. Russia has a major role in the Iranian nuclear plans. I mean, they're the ones that supply Iran. And, you know, the United States is basically, its hegemony is a thing of the past. That's the bottom line here. There's no doubt about it in my mind. I mean, even militarily, as we're talking now, what we're talking now is basic geopolitical military terms and how helpless the United States is in the face of this situation. And a country that I think emerges kind of unharmed here and in a very, very much stronger position than they've ever been is China. That spells gold standard to me. You know, I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but it's all the more reason for investors to hold precious metals. I mean, yeah, they've been disappointing. And, gosh, I mean, I started writing a publication. I think the first issue was around 1978. I think the Dow was around 800 at that time. And, you know, all I could say is that there's no downside in this market. And basically I was right, but I said there's massive upside, but I couldn't say when. And, you know, it took 4 years, but I was right. I was right. So, I mean, I think in gold there's as much upside in gold as there was in the Dow when it was at 800. Literally, I think gold could go up 10 or 15-fold because you're going to have to, you know, whatever currency – however it's used, there's going to have to be enough of it in value to back up all international trade, and that takes you 10 or 15 times higher than what it is today. Then you might be able to, you know, get somewhere in the world, because then all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about actors, becomes much broader, becomes in, yeah, I mean, you have a much broader range of players to choose from. It's not like the United States on its own, which is really the case today. It could be the United States, China, Russia, who knows? Everybody could be on their own, but it would be under a different kind of monetary regime and a different kind of worldwide regime, and one in which China, I think, might play the prominent part. That's where I think we're headed.
You brought up some great points, and you talked about the precious metals. But, you know, the investment du jour is still equities and bonds.
It was in 2007, too. And, you know, and it may remain the, you know, look, I'm not bearish on stocks at all here. I think stocks will go higher. And you know, my perspective here is not, you know, 2 or 3 months. It really is, you know, the next several years. So, yeah, I totally agree that the investment du jour is, in fact, stocks, and I think it's likely to remain stocks for some time to come. But that does not in any way mean that in 5 years stocks are going to be higher than they are today and gold's going to be, you know, lower. No, I think that if your perspective is a little bit longer term, you really want to talk about precious metals and gold.
Absolutely, and of course that's music to the ears of our listeners. But at the same time, I think for 5 years now, since, as you mentioned, the bottom there, the nadir of the bear market, the Great Recession, stocks just simply have chugged along. And we have seen, as I'm sure you know, an awful lot of stock repurchases by top corporations, and this reduces the supply. They're buying back their own shares, supporting their stock price. This has been a theme that we've seen. We see a very robust IPO market. You know, the Alibaba, just one of the latest and a long litany of companies to go public with success. And I guess you can really look at it from two perspectives, can't you? I mean, these are the hallmarks of a bull market, but they can also be viewed as, from a contrarian perspective, as a bit frothy. What's your take?
I'm not I don't think anything's happening here that's frothy. I'm not bearish on the market at all here. In fact, I would say I'm kind of bullish on the market, but I'm talking longer term. You know, sometimes, very rarely are there bells and whistles to tell you that the market's going to go down 30 or 40 or 50%. I don't think that's around the corner right now. I think that I'd be a little bit concerned about bonds. I think they're getting a little bit frothy here, but I think that, you know, stocks can go higher. I mean, there's massive amounts of money out there, and I think stocks will go higher. But, you know, you're talking about the geopolitical events, and how they're eventually going to play out, I think it's going to end in tears. That's the way I see it. It will, I think, end in tears. And I'm not going to try and time it, but I think that, you know, it will end, and when it ends, it'll end very, very badly. And I think very badly for the U.S., and I think that, you know, from a 5 or 10 year perspective, even less than 10, 5 year perspective, precious metals will dramatically outperform stocks, dramatically, not even in the same ballpark, dramatically.
But, you know, Dr. Lieb, I'm asking guests to prognosticate a bit, keeping in mind the adage, you know, prediction is fraught with difficulties, particularly when it regards the future. Because I think that you have the perspective and the wherewithal to tackle this question. I'd like to know whether or not you view this as the next ultimate zenith. Is this going to be the peak that our progeny looks back in equities, U.S. equities, as that 1929 moment, or perhaps the ultimate zenith?
That comes around to, you know, whether an asteroid's going to strike the Earth. I don't think civilization's going to disappear. But I think that, you know, most historians, I think, would agree that, you know, China's been the number one civilization and economy for 16 out of the last 18 centuries. And I don't think China wants to make it 16 out of 19. So I think that there's been a massive move to the from west to east, and that move is in terms of economic power, in terms of military power, certainly in terms of, I think, monetary power now. I mean, all the trading in gold is basically going to end up in yuan. So, you know, once China starts, once gold starts being denominated in yuan, and then, you know, the Chinese are in a position to say, well, here we have a currency. We're the biggest trader in the world right now, and now we're going to back our currency up with gold. It's already denominated in yuan. You know, and the dollar is sitting here, you know, where you've got $4 trillion in the Federal Reserve Bank backed up by nothing. And you've got real wages in this country having declined at least since the beginning of this century. Some people argue since 1970. And, you know, basically you have a very, very strong stock market. There's no doubt you do. But I don't think that's going to carry the day. I mean, you know, so what? I mean, you know, you've had a few people get extremely wealthy. I don't think that that's an argument for, you know, a country's infrastructure, a country's ability to, you know, run itself. I mean, our energy policy, I think, is a catastrophe in this country. I don't think we're doing anything with regard to renewable energies to speak of, whereas China, Germany, and other countries are doing much, much, much more. And it's just not a situation that I think can end, you know, well for us. I mean, eventually it may. When you say, is it an ultimate zenith? I think it's going to be a major top. And I think it's going to be a real blow, not just a shot across the bow, but it will hit hard. And I think for a while, America will play second fiddle in the world in a lot of ways. That doesn't mean that we can't come back. I think there's a great spirit that underlies this country. I love this country. But I think that we became way too complacent, and I think we're going to pay for that. That doesn't mean that we're going to pay forever. That doesn't mean that our progeny's progeny are going to look back at these times and say, well, this was the end of America as they knew it. No, I'm not that smart. I can't look that far ahead, but I can say that, you know, we're living through a point of inflection right now. Mm-hmm. And it's not too hard to get the stock market to go up when you, you know, control money presses. It is hard to get real wages to go up, however, and we're not succeeding there at all. In fact, we're failing miserably. And it's real wages that, you know, is affecting 90-95% of the population. They're not benefiting. So when you say the stock market's going up, to me that's not a good argument for, you know, what's happening in the world today.
Very good. Well, I love to hear that term, inflection point. And another function, another term from calculus, we're talking about how these geopolitical events come together in a single function and affect the markets.
I mean, you know, basically Russia got exactly what they wanted. That was, you know, I think a sign of weakness in the United States. I mean, Russia did exactly what they wanted, really didn't miss a beat doing it. And that's tragic. I mean, it's totally tragic, but they did. And I think the United States facilitated it. I think that basically by, you know, initially supporting the Ukraine, well, we're getting off topic here, but by initially supporting the people in, what, Madden Square, as strongly as they did, I think that they led to the fleeing of the then president of Ukraine and, you know, some sort of chaos, and then that allowed Russia to take over the Crimea, or gave them an excuse to do that. And then, you know, we've tried slapping sanctions on them, and they sort of laughed at those sanctions and slapped their own sanctions. And now what you have is Russia's been free to move their troops into the eastern part of the country, and you'll have some sort of federalism there. And I don't think Russia, I don't think has any plans right now to annex the Ukraine. But, you know, after Obama's, you know, threats once, after the threats following the takeover of the Crimea, it just has to strike you. It's a frisson of fear and agony when you see him in Estonia assuring, you know, this Baltic state that, you know, NATO's behind them. And the Estonians saying, you know, we don't want NATO here. We don't want to tempt the Russians. So, I mean, this is just not the sign of a great power succeeding. This is a sign of a power, you know, basically falling backwards. And then the same power is fighting, you know, this situation in the Middle East, et cetera, while China continues to motor along. So, you know, what more can I say? I wish it were this way.
You seem to imply here that Russia is the biggest victor, but, you know, some of our guests have pointed to the oil companies having, Western oil companies, having infused many of their executives and some of our political leaders into the region, and I'm referring to Ukraine, and how that seems to be a victory on their behalf. Any comments?
Well, Western oil companies, yeah, I mean, they never lose. They're just worldwide oil companies domiciled in the U.S. They're not going to lose. But that's not a victory for the U.S. I mean, that's a victory for, you know, a particular segment of U.S. industry, right? I mean, that's, you know, yeah, they could benefit in certain ways. I don't think they're going to benefit much from being in the Ukraine, but they may benefit. It's hard. The big beneficiary here is obviously China. I mean, you know, the message here to Russia is that you've got to look toward the south, toward your south, or partially south, anyway, toward China, not toward Europe. And that's what they've done. I mean, who knows how much gas and oil they've agreed to send and trade with China. But it's, you know, it's a significant fraction of $1 trillion, if not a trillion. And, you know, at the same time, China's buying Russian gold mines and investing in Russian oil companies. So, you know, the real victor here is not Western oil companies. It's really China.
Very good. Well, let's shift gears back to the precious metals market. And, you know, we've seen some interesting developments in the markets, a lot of weakness lately. And it appears to be setting up a potential capitulation moment, if you will, or a scenario at least where the final holdouts toss up their hands, the weak hands say, I can't take any more pain. And the deep pockets come in and say, okay, this is what we've been waiting for. This is the, as you say, the inflection point. And, we see a sea change in sentiment from that point forward. Do you see something like that on the radar screen for us?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form to see something like that occur. I mean, some sort of, you know, real final shakeout and then, you know, see precious metals come back. What complicates things a little bit here, Chris, is that, you know, we're talking about precious metals as measured in dollars. And, you know, more and more, I think, as I said before, I think they're going to be measured in yuan. So it's going to depend upon, you know, yeah, you might get a shakeout from the dollar holders, but you're certainly not going to get a shakeout from the yuan holders. I mean, you know, they're probably going to buy. So I don't know whether you're going to see some sort of final shakeout or capitulation, or you're going to see something like you saw in 1982 in the stock market. I mean, if you remember back in 1982, I'm sure you don't, you're too young, but I wasn't. and I lived through it, and everybody was looking at, you know, bottoms, 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 and you never got a bottom. And then one day, I think on a Friday or Monday or whatever, market just shot up out of nowhere. I mean, you know, I think Henry Kaufman and Wozenlauer, they changed their view on interest rates or something like that. I mean, wasn't much of a catalyst, but there was really no capitulation. There could be some capitulation. I'm not ruling it out, but I'm saying that if you're waiting for that moment to invest, don't.
That's interesting, too, because we also saw signs of that in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index. You know, we had a three-year decline. We may have approached 90% on the downside from peak to trough. Yeah. But then you know what? We never really had anything after that. We had three sine wave years of just consolidation back and forth. And what if we had something similar here in the precious metal?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, you can't really, you know, describe what a bottom is going to look like. What you can do, I think, with some certainty or some degree of assurance is say that gold, yeah, it could go down a little bit more, maybe another 10% from here. But, you know, the upside is just dramatically higher than the downside. And, you know, the shape and scope of its bottom, I don't think that's the game to play here. I think the game to play here is, again, to recognize the shift in the world from west to east and to know that, you know, the real winning investments in that shift will be precious metals, real objects, commodities, et cetera. Listen, because I do believe in what I'm saying, and I, you know, I'm in this business to try and help people. But
you're not selling anything, and that's what I appreciate. Yeah, you're not pandering to the audience here. You have nothing to gain. Why don't I give you a chance here to give folks your takeaway point?
Well, I think I've shared, you know, most of my, you know, longer-term beliefs. I'm writing a book on, you know, gold-related investments and why I think it's critical to own them. I mean, that book will probably won't be published for at least a year. That's one of my core beliefs. And, you know, I do want to say without any guile whatsoever that I hope that I'm dead wrong, that I hope that, you know, something comes out of the woodwork that I'm completely unaware of and makes me look like an idiot in advocating these kinds of positions because, you know, I don't like it. I don't like to see our country on the edge and between a rock and a hard place and, you know, all those other things that I've said. I don't like saying them. I don't like feeling them. But that basically is what I feel right now. And I think that everybody would be well advised having some gold and other gold correlated investments in their portfolio. How much, you know, that's up to them to decide. But I think it's a very, very good idea to do.
Very good. And do you have any words of wisdom or consolation for those of us who have held out in the silver camp during three brutal years?
Silver will go dramatically higher. I mean, I think silver will outperform gold. I think the recent breakdown in silver was kind of silly. I mean, it went through a support zone and everyone sold. It's ridiculous. There's a company, you know, it's impossible to buy this company, but I look at it from time to time. It's called Giga Solar, and they sell solar panels into China. And they may sell them into other countries, too. But, I mean, they're going gangbusters. So, you know, the demand for silver is there. It's going to increase steadily, industrial demand, that is. And I think that the investment demand is obviously going to increase if I'm right on gold. So, yeah, I think silver is going to probably outperform or at least perform as well as gold, if not outperform gold going forward. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to this recent breakdown in silver. I think it has no meaning whatsoever. This doesn't mean silver can't go to $15, but I mean, I think silver will end up being a three-digit metal, well past $100 in most of our lifetimes. Maybe not mine, but within the next 5 years, I think you'll see silver in three digits.
Well, we certainly hope that that is the case, that you will enjoy many, many decades to come with silver in the triple-digit zone. That's going to please all of us.
Yes, I think you will see that.
Dr. Stephen Lieb, we know your schedule is quite busy and you've been gracious with your time. Oh, and look forward to your wonderful upcoming Precious Metals book. I know listeners will want to get a copy.
As I said, you have about a year or so to wait, but yes. And it's a book like a lot of books I've written. I hope I'm dead wrong. But I don't see anything right now to say I am. So I would, again, advise people to own precious metals and assets that are correlated with precious metals, silver, gold, and, you know, whatever else. Thank you so much, Chris.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I am recording this installment on Black Friday, traditionally the busiest shopping day of the year. My inbox is filled with discount codes for items I have inquired about this year, but never purchased. Stores and restaurants are madhouses despite the ailing economy. And today, for the third year in a row, a small group of Walmart employees at stores nationwide have once again gone on strike in support of higher wages and better hours. According to a report in the Huffington Post, Walmart has downplayed the significance of the strikes in recent years, because they involve a tiny portion of Walmart's 1 million-plus workforce in the United States. The group representing the striking workers is called Our Walmart, and according to the Huffington Post report, puts the number of strikers in the hundreds each year, while Walmart puts the number of strikers in the dozens. If those numbers are accurate, then even several hundred strikers out of over 4,000 Walmart stores nationwide works out to only one striker out of every 20 stores. Statistically, that's not a very high number. The article named stores in six states where strikes were set to occur, and four other states where they were anticipated to occur. On the flip side, other articles, like a local CBS article, says that some 400 workers are expected to join a picket line at the Walmart store in Milpitas, California, and that some 1,600 strikes and protests are planned at other stores nationwide as well. That's a pretty big discrepancy from the other article. Who's going to fact-check this? What are people actually going to believe? Are these actual striking workers, or locals in support of the concept? It's reporting like this in mainstream media that convinces so many of how they know what isn't so. That aside, an interesting aspect of the Walmart strike message this year is the same mantra reflected in earlier reports from last year regarding rallies for an increased minimum wage of $15 an hour at McDonald's and other fast food restaurants, put forth by fast food strikers backed by the Service Employees International Union. Regardless of your opinion on such matters, this theme of a $15 an hour minimum wage keeps resurfacing and will not go away. I believe it will continue to gain traction, especially as real inflation can no longer be masked and hidden from the masses. Those on the lowest end of the economic ladder already know that inflation is alive and well, despite official reporting. As the inflation tide continues to rise and slowly waterboard more and more individuals and families, the idea of a $15 an hour minimum wage won't seem so ridiculous. Does it now? Perhaps. But on Black Friday next year, maybe not so much. And two Black Fridays from now? As in after the next presidential election? All bets are off. These strikes at Walmart may be staged and managed to some degree. But the message of a $15 an hour minimum wage is the canary in the coal mine that cannot be ignored. Its voice is going to grow louder and louder as the economy moves into more uncharted territory. Have you ever heard a canary scream? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.